courage and consequence. He's also a native Coloradoan. Please help me welcome Carl Rove. Carl?
Thank you. Sit down. Sit down. Thank you. Sit down. Behave yourselves. The sooner we get started, the sooner we get it over with. Thank you, Bill, for that overly generous and largely inaccurate introduction. This is one damn confident organization to have a man with a ponytail coming in as your president. I'd say you're hip and cool, but I know otherwise. I want to thank Bill Firkins and Bayer for sponsoring me. Everything that I say after this should not be held responsible to my sponsors. I was interested listening to Bill, listening to him about his Facebook page, coming up with his mottos. I had a similar experience. I got interviewed by Vanity Fair, a bunch of snobby East Coast liberals. They said, "What's your motto?" Hadn't given much thought to a motto, but I had to fill out the questionnaire, so I thought, what is my motto? And then I remembered I'd been walking through the airport, and a couple of military guys came up to me and said, "We like you a lot, and we want to give you our unit coin." And it's a favorite of mine. I have a big collection of unit coins for various units of our armed forces, and it's right in the center of it. It's from the Black Horse. So I put it in Vanity Fair as my slogan, right there in the back of the, you know, they had Marilyn Monroe was the, you know, big article on her, and Jacqueline Onassis, and then there on the back page of it is the interview with me, and down there it says, "What is your motto?" And I put the motto of the Black Horse: "Find the bastards and pile on." I was talking with Betsy and Bill last night because last summer I was in, they live on the east side of the Crazy Mountains in Montana, and I was on the west side. And they live in a beautiful part of our country, and I got to spend a couple of days on the other side of the mountains from where they are. They're in the part of the mountains where you can see the day that's coming. I was on the side of the mountains where you see the day that's going. But I had a wonderful time. And afterwards, I got to thinking last night about Montana because, as you know, there's sort of a connection between Texas and Montana. We're sort of celebrating in a minor way now. 20th anniversary of Lonesome Dove. Great epic tale. Remember, Augustus McCrae and Woodward Call set out on this epic journey from Texas to the green plains of Montana to raise their cattle. And it doesn't end up too well for one of the Texans, as you recall. Augustus gets set upon by Indians and is killed. But it's a great bit of drama. What you may not know is that it's based in reality. Did you know that? Did you know that that episode happened? 1867. One broke-down Texas cattleman named Oliver Loving. He'd gone broke in the Civil War by selling his cattle to the Confederates for worthless paper dollars. He had a young partner, 31-year-old Charles Goodnight. And the two of them, in the midst of a terrible time in Texas in 1867, got a hard-won contract to supply beef and horses to Fort Sumner, to the federal troops at Fort Sumner, New Mexico. Only problem was nobody knew how to get them out there. And they pioneered what has become known as the Goodnight Loving Trail. And it was an epic journey, much like the movie, or much like the TV show. And because they didn't know the water and the grass along the Pecos, they broke the herd up into several groups. And the first unit was led by Oliver Loving and one cowboy named Bill Wilson. And as they neared Fort Sumner, they were set upon by Indians. These two men, the Indians drove the herd of cattle and horse off and cornered them in a dugout on the Pecos River. Oliver was shot in the side, and so in the middle of the night, Bill Wilson sneaks out of the dugout to try and go for help, just like P.I. Parker did in Lonesome Dove. And for 2 days, in a dugout on the Pecos River, Oliver Loving holds off the Indians. gets shot a couple of times. His wrist is all busted up, but gets shot. At one point, the Indians dig within 2 feet. They dig through the back of the embankment and dig within 2 feet of his dugout. But they are so frightened by this warrior that they can't bring themselves to dig it through and confront him. And after 2 nights of fighting, fatigue and hunger and fear and badly wounded, he makes his way out of the dugout in the middle of the night and up the Pecos River. Not down as in the TV show, but up the Pecos River. And for 3 days, in the middle of nowhere in southeastern New Mexico, wanders in search of civilization and help. And in J. Evetts Haley's great book about Charlie Goodnight, he recounts the tale of what happened next. In the middle of nowhere, a wagon with, as Goodnight said, 3 Mexicans and a German boy are making their way east to Texas, and they stop for the night, and the German boy goes into a grove of trees to get firewood and finds in the grove of trees Oliver Loving flat out asleep on the prairie near death. They take him to Fort Sumner. They patch up the wound in his side, and they amputate his arm. And he sends word for his partner, Charles Goodnight. Goodnight's making his way up to the trail and is met by a courier and hastens to Fort Sumner, where he finds his partner, who in the meantime has found out where the herd is. And so Goodnight goes off and with a couple of cowboys recaptures the herd of cattle and horses and brings them into Sumner to fulfill the contract. In the meantime, however, Oliver Loving's taken a turn for the worse. His amputated arm is turning bad, and they got to go back in and retie the artery. And when they do, he gets ill and begins to die, probably of blood poisoning. He's nearing death, and he summons his partner. And he says to Charles Goodnight, he says, I want you to do 2 things for me. He said, I want you to keep our partnership alive for 2 years so you can pay my debts and make provision for my family. And then he said, I don't want to be buried in a foreign country. Even back then, New Mexico had an image problem. And he asked Goodnight to bury him in Texas. And Goodnight says, I'll write out a document giving you, writing out the terms of our agreement. And Loving says to him, I want your promise as a Mason. He said, your promise is all I want. They shook hands, and Loving died. They buried him temporarily at Fort Sumner, and a couple months later, Charles Goodnight, with a couple of cowboys, came and made a wagon at Fort Sumner and took the body home to Texas, across the plains of the Llano Escondido, which was not settled at the time, and took him to Weatherford, Texas, and buried him in the Masonic Cemetery in Weatherford, Texas, where he is. And Haley recounts that for the next 63 years of Charles Goodnight's life, this man lived to be 94 years old, proves to be eating beef is good for longevity. For 63 years, J. Evetts Haley says, Oliver Loving's memory was not far from the memory of, from the thoughts of his partner, Charles Goodnight. You know, it's a reminder of a country that we were and are, where a man's word is his bond, where character matters, where you can dream big dreams and do the impossible, and where liberty and freedom and responsibility went hand in hand. These men had obligations to each other. These values are important when we deal with the big challenges that our country's facing today, and I want to talk about them. I want to talk first about the challenges, and then I want to talk about the values. Some of the big challenges we face are, frankly, a little bit easier than they might have looked a year or two ago. We got a big challenge of making our country prosperous by selling to people outside the United States of America. We're 5% of the world's population, and we cannot be a prosperous and dynamic country if we just take in each other's laundry or try and sell only each other our beef. We got to find ways to take the things that we grow and produce and manufacture and create and sell them all around the world, because America can compete anywhere in the world as long as the rules are fair and the playing field is level. Now, after languishing for a couple of years, we got a chance to unstick it on trade. The president's come forward and said he's in favor now of South Korea and Colombia and Panama. And if we get it done, Maybe it'll get these two squabbling parties in Washington, D.C. to agree that we ought to do more of that and knock down the trade barriers all around the world to the export of American goods and services. Because guess what? We got competitors around the world like Brazil that are happy for us to be sitting here fat and happy, not knocking down those obstacles and thinking we don't need those kind of trade agreements. So if we get these three agreements unstuck and passed this year, maybe the Congress of the United States and the President of the United States will realize it is in our strategic and economic interest to be selling things all around the world, including quality American beef. There is something about an American product that speaks to everybody around this world. People don't run around saying, oh, God, I want one of those Yugoslavian beef. They don't say, geez, I want one of those Madagascar electronic components. They don't say, you know, something that comes from, Nicaragua or Malaysia really sings to my heart. There's something about American quality, American innovation, and American products that make them attractive all around the world, and we ought to be selling to them. But unfortunately, that's where the easy stuff stops. We got other big challenges, starting with the state of the American economy. And we got a big problem with it because when the economy went into the tank, because people got irresponsible in their lending practices and nearly brought down the world financial system with them, what was our response? Our government said the answer is we want a strong economy because if we have a strong economy, people are able, they got some money in their pockets and they can buy things. And that creates more prosperity. So what do we do to create prosperity? Well, what we do is we pass a gigantic $862 billion stimulus bill. And if we pass it, the president said, unemployment will top out at 8% by the end of the summer of 2009 and decline rapidly thereafter. So we pass the bill, and unemployment today is 9.5% and likely to go up tomorrow. A year and a half after it was supposed to hit 8% and be trending downward. We got 6 million people, fewer employed people in America today than we were told we would have than if we passed the stimulus bill. We got 3 million fewer people working than were working the day that the stimulus bill was passed. And why didn't it work? Look, I'm Carl. I'm a recovering government bureaucrat. I worked in the White House for 7 years, and when you work there, you start reading this stuff and paying attention to it. I always read the footnotes. I always pay attention to the chart and really read all of the appendices. You read the appendix and you'll find out what they really wanted to say to you. On January 9th of 2009, the incoming administration put out an important document laying out the philosophical underpinnings of the stimulus program. Pretty smart move, saying even before the new guy gets in, we want to demonstrate our commitment to creating jobs and prosperity, so we're going to put out a document spelling out why we need a stimulus bill and why it's important for our country. Appendix number 1 has a nice little chart in there. It says for every dollar spent by the government under the stimulus program, there will be $1.55 in economic growth. I want you to noodle on that for just a moment. Government spends a dollar of our money, and we magically get $1.55 in economic growth. Now, if that's the case, why did we stop at $862 billion? We should have done like the $10 trillion stimulus bill. We would have had $15 trillion of economic growth, and we could have thrown one hell of a good party on the $5 trillion we magically created out of nowhere. Look, I took freshman macroeconomics. Got a pretty good grade at it. I told one of my assistants at the time chart in the appendix, I said, I want you to go back and take a look at every freshman macroeconomics textbook that is widely used and distributed today in American colleges and find out what they say about the average feedback, the multiplier. If a government spends a dollar on a stimulus plan, how much economic growth does it create? You know what it is? Spend a dollar and how much growth do you get? On average, 84 cents. You're robbing growth from the future and you got to pay the piper sometime. Look, these guys think that you can magically create growth by spending money. There has never been a country in the history of the world that has spent its way to prosperity. You work, you save, you invest, you struggle, and you fight in order to get prosperity. You don't create it by simply having government go out there and spend our taxpayer dollars in doing so. It doesn't work that way. So we got to do something to get our economy going, and it ain't what we've been doing. That stimulus bill was about the worst designed stimulus bill you could have. Did you know that there's $5 billion in the stimulus bill for obesity counseling and smoking cessation? Now, look, I could afford to lose a few pounds, and I don't smoke and don't really condone it, but what the hell does that have to do with stimulating the economy? I have yet to meet an out-of-work fat coach. But this idea of spending $862 billion over the next decade, which costs us $1 trillion when you add in the interest cost because we didn't have a dime of that $862 billion. You know, first of all, a trillion. What is a trillion? It is 1,000 billions of dollars. It is 100,000 millions of dollars. That's a big amount of money. We spent $1 trillion on a stimulus bill that didn't stimulate the economy. But guess what? That wasn't the only trillion we spent. The administration came in, and between January 20th of 2009 and the beginning of the fiscal year, October 1, 2009, they increased the discretionary domestic budget of the United States by over $1 trillion over the next decade. They increased the baseline of the spending by almost $100 billion in the first year, which if you look at it over the decade means we've committed the government to being spending $1 trillion more than it would otherwise spend as of January 19th, the day before the new administration took office. That's our second additional $1 trillion. And the government now has taken 25% of the GDP. 25% of our economy is now going to the government. Under Reagan, it was 22%. Under Bush 41, it was 22%. Under Clinton, it was 19.8%. And under Bush, it was 19.6%, 19.6%. And now we're at 25%. Think about that. The government, in that short period of time, goes from being about one out of every $5 of our economy to being one out of every four. That's a big jump. And as a result, it means the government is taking a bigger slice of what ought to be in the pockets of Americans to spend and invest and save as they see fit. And then finally, we get to health care. First of all, I'm trying to figure out what we're trying to do here. I know we got a problem in health care in the country, but what is the problem? We were told we got 46 million uninsured Americans. That's an awful lot of Americans. That's a big number. But what is that number? I looked into it. Census Bureau is actually the group that put together the number. And if you look at it, of that 46 million uninsured Americans, 9.7 million of them are legal or illegal aliens. Now look, I'm pro-immigration, but I don't think it ought to be the responsibility of the U.S. taxpayer to be picking up the cost for health care for people who are not U.S. citizens. Just shouldn't. We got 15 million people who are uninsured in America today who make $50,000 or more. In fact, we've got several million people who are uninsured in America today who make more than $250,000 a year. Now look, I wish they had insurance. And if they got sick or got in an accident, I bet they wish they had insurance too. But guess what? They can afford it. Even if it's a bare-bones catastrophic policy, you're making $7,500,000 a year, you're making $50,000 a year, you can get a bare-bones policy. And the last time I looked, we are still a nation of individual responsibility, and people are responsible for their own actions. We shouldn't be picking up the tab for people who can afford it themselves. That doesn't do our country any good. We got 14 million people. Yeah. We got 14 million people. 14 million out of that number who are already eligible for some form of government-provided health care assistance. They're already eligible for Medicaid, SCHIP, Medicare, Indian health care, TRICARE, CHAMPAS, VA, even federal employee retiree benefit program. And guess what? They haven't signed up for it. The government's done such a lousy job that we got 14 million people running around the country who are eligible for coverage that we haven't gotten signed up. So the government's done such a lousy job signing them up. Let's create a new program that discombobulates the relationship of all 300 million other Americans in order to fix the job that we didn't get when we didn't sign them up. Maybe we ought to work on fixing the programs we already got without creating a new one. Now, 46 million, 46 minus 10 minus 15 minus 14 leaves you about 4, 5, 6 million people. And that's a big number. And I worry about those people. Those are people who are working. And they make too much to get Medicaid and not enough to afford it on their own, and their employer can't provide it or doesn't provide it to them. But rather than coming up with some gigantic 2,000-page bill that we don't fully understand, why don't we focus on ways to help those 5 million or 6 million people have lower costs and greater access to health care, the best health care in the world, which is American health care, rather than discombobulating everybody else. That'd be too, you know, let's get complex. Let's make it big. Let's make it complicated. And let's do things that are going to hurt us. Now, I've been watching this bill carefully and looking at it closely. I'm sort of become obsessive about it. If I begin to fulminate here and fall down on the stage and begin to roll around, just simply throw a blanket over me and it'll go pass in a few minutes. But virtually every single promise made about this bill is turning out not to be true. Candidate Obama said, "I want comprehensive health care reform that will lower premiums for every family in the country by $2,500 per family." And yet already the Congressional Budget Office has come out and said that premiums in the individual market will be $2,100 higher than they would have been otherwise if we'd done nothing. PricewaterhouseCoopers did a study and said over the next decade, health insurance premiums were estimated to rise 80%. Now that the bill is passed, they will rise on average 111% because of all the mandates and rules and requirements. Oh, we need to do this because as a nation, we're spending too much on health care. Let's bend that health care curve down. By passing this bill as a nation, we're going to spend less on health care, freeing up more money that we can spend on other things. And yet now the Congressional Budget Office and the Department of Health and Human Services come out and said, oh, guess what, little mistake, we as a nation are going to spend $311 billion more on health care over the next decade than if we did nothing. Oh, if you like what you got, you can keep it. If you like your current coverage, don't worry, not going to be affected. Well, guess what? If you're one of the 13 million Americans on Medicare Advantage, already the government admits 7 million of you are going to lose your coverage. 700,000 lost it last year in advance of the Medicare cuts. This year there will be $2 trillion worth of Medicare cuts. Next year there will be $6 million worth of Medicare cuts. And the number of people whose policies are not going to be renewed is going to be escalating. We got two companies, the Principal Financial of Iowa and Guardian, which are big providers, already have left the market. They're providing no health insurance at all, canceling every single one of their policies. And they're being followed by dozens of much smaller companies. You try getting a child-only policy in America today, no longer possible. Could buy one 2 years ago, could buy one last year, can't get one this year. And not only that, but it's going to get worse and worse and worse and worse. I was having dinner with a guy in Dallas, Texas. 100,000 employees, restaurant business. I said, what's health care reform going to do to you? He said, I'm putting out $25 million a year in premium support for my employees, and they tell me when the bill is fully phased in by 2016, I'm going to be putting out $90 million a year. He says, I don't have $65 million a year in free cash flow. I said, what are you going to do? He said, I'm going to do two things. I'm going to dump my coverage for every single employee starting with me and pay the $2,000 fine instead of putting out the $8,400 I'm now putting out for coverage. And he said, the second thing I'm going to do is, because the law says that a full-time employee is anybody who works 31 hours or more a week, he said, I'm going to put in place so that any part-time worker of our restaurants doesn't get more than 31 hours. And he says, it's going to cause hardship for my people. He said, I got the college kid who works 10 hours a week during school and then in the summer tries to get every hour he can so he can put together the money to go back to school that fall. And he's not going to be able to get his 40 or 45 hours. I got the single working mom who needs 34, 35 hours a week to make her nut, feed her child, and take care of herself. And I'm going to have to tell her she gets 31 hours at my facility and she's got to find her 2 or 3 or 4 hours somewhere else. But he said, I can't afford it. And it's not just the big guys, it's a lot of little guys. I'm driving around Johnson County, Kansas last year with a guy who runs a construction company, 70 employees, $500,000 a year is what he puts out for health care today, $50 million in sales. He said, I made money in 08. He said, I broke even in 09 with $50 million in sales because everybody was sharpening their pencils. He said, I'll have $50 million of sales in 10 and I'll lose money. And he said, I'm putting out $500,000 a year for health care coverage for my employees. He said, what's going to happen to me is they tell me that my bill is going to be $800,000 or $900,000. I don't have the money, and what I'm going to do is flush my coverage because I get a pass on my first 40 employees, and I get a $2,000 fine on the next 30, so I'm going to exchange a $500,000 current obligation for a $60,000 fine or an $800,000 or $900,000 obligation for a $60,000 fine. And guess what? That means the cost of the program is going to balloon like you cannot imagine, because the assumption is that only 19 million people are going to lose their coverage and be tossed into the exchanges and have all the rest of us pick up their health care cost rather than their provider or their employer. And guess what? The estimates now are that it may be between 85 and 117 million people who lose their coverage because the employer says, it doesn't make any sense for me anymore. Oh, this is not going to interfere in the patient-doctor relationship. It ain't. Having 159 new federal panels, agencies, bureaus, or commissions putting out rules and regulations is going to do nothing to get in the middle of having a good relationship between the doc and the patient. If you believe that, go talk to your doc. In November, the Physicians Foundation came out with a scary study. 60% of doctors said that this bill will cause them to severely curtail their services. 87% said it would cause them to severely curtail their services to Medicare patients, and 93% said to Medicaid patients. And not only that, but 40% of docs say, I'm looking to get out of the business. I know this. Look, I'm from Texas. I have to have a hunting lease. It's a moral obligation of a Texan to have a hunting lease. On my hunting lease, we are obligated to have, of course, the commercial real estate guy. We're obligated to have, which we got a couple of those boys. You're obligated to have a couple of the, you know, sort of the guys who get checks in the mail. We got a couple of those guys. You're obligated to have a couple of people who actually make a living. I think one of my partners here. Is Hughes Abel around here? Where are you, Hughes? I got one of my partners that's supposed to be here. He's probably late. He's a cattleman from New Mexico and Texas. But you also, in Texas, if you have a hunting lease, you're obligated to have several members of the healthcare field. So on our lease, we've got the cardiologist, the bone guy, and the general surgeon. Thank God they're not good shots. Leaves more birds for the rest of us. But they're damn good fun. But sitting around the campfire the last couple of months has been sobering, because every one of them is making a plan to leave the healthcare field earlier. I was planning to stay in 10 years. I'm now trying to get out in 5. I was planning to be involved 7 more years. I'm trying to try and get out 3. I was planning to be 5. I'm going to get out in 2, and I've got a plan to do it. But the biggest problem with this bill is that the president said it wouldn't add a dime to the deficit. He's right. It won't. It will not add a dime to the deficit. It will not add one dime. It will add ungodly numbers of dimes to the deficit. We sent Bernie Madoff to jail for 155 years for financial shenanigans that aren't as bad as what we got in this bill. They said when they passed it that the cost of the bill was $940 billion. Then 2 months later, the Congressional Budget Office came out and said, oh, we made a little bitty itsy mistake. We forgot to calculate the cost, the discretionary cost of implementing the bill, which will be $115 billion more. Now, when it was $940 billion, they said, this thing is going to reduce the deficit. We're going to go spend $940 billion, and it's going to reduce the deficit by $143 billion. Ain't it great? Go spend a bunch of money, and it reduces the deficit. Sort of hard to figure out how that worked, but they made the claim. Well, then they come back and say, oh, wait a minute, we forgot to include that $115 billion. So suddenly the savings go from $143 to $128. But then you peek inside the bill, and you'll find they're double counting. They cut Medicare by $456 billion over the next 10 years. And they said, this is a good thing. We're spending way too much on Medicare. We got a $30 trillion unfunded liability over the next 75 years. And by cutting $456 billion over the next 10 years, that ripples out over the next 65 years that follow. And we really reduce, almost erase, the unfunded liability of Medicare. Ain't it grand? Ain't it great? Oh, and incidentally, did we mention that at the same time that we're planning that $456 billion to pay off the unfunded liability of Medicare, we're spending it on the current expenses of the new health care program? They assume that people lose their coverage and that their employer gives them a little bit extra money, and that over the course of the decade, as a result of health care reform, people will pay $53 billion more in Social Security payroll taxes, which is supposed to go over into the Social Security lockbox and be there to pay the benefit of the people who paid the money in. Like, let's say Bill Donald pays that extra money in. Money's supposed to be over there waiting to give him a slightly bigger check. But, oh, at the same time, they're sitting over there waiting to pay Bill's check. We're spending it on the current expenses of the health care program. They create a new entitlement called CLASS, which is a long-term care policy. So you can get a $50 a day benefit, competes with private insurance, but government's going to provide it. So they assume people are going to go buy this because the government's going to price it less than the private market, and people are going to pay $72 billion in insurance premiums for the CLASS long-term care program, and it's going to be sitting over there in the premium pool waiting to pay Bill Donald's benefit when he needs to get that $50 a day assistance for in-home health care. Oh, and at the same time it's over there in the insurance pool, we're taking that money and spending it on the current expenses of the health care program. Look, I got a 21-year-old off of college. He gets a certain amount of money each month. I say to him, Bubba, when it's gone, it's gone. But in Washington, you can spend it twice. You can spend it there and you can spend it over there. You take a look at the double counting in this bill, as Congressman Paul Ryan, the new Budget Committee chairman, has done. This thing is not in the black in the first 10 years in office. It is $701 billion in the red. Now remember, we have 10 years worth of tax increases on insurance companies, drug companies, and medical device companies, and 10 years worth of Medicare cuts on senior health care in order to pay for a program that doesn't begin spending money really in essence until 2014 and is not fully ramped up until 2016 and spends over 80% of the $1.055 trillion between 2016 and 2019. We got 10 years worth of revenue to fund 4 years of a program that is $710 billion in the red at near number 10. How sustainable do you think that is over the long haul? It isn't sustainable at all. If we do it, it's going to not only add $1 trillion more to the budget for the next 10 years, but it is going to absolutely bankrupt the country. No ifs, ands, or buts. I mean, I want you to think about this. We've added $1 trillion in spending to the baseline of the budget, $1 trillion in spending as a result of the stimulus bill, $1 trillion in spending as a result of the health care bill. We have added 300,000 millions of dollars to the budget over the next 10 years, and every single bit of it, or virtually every single bit of it, is red ink. We're going to go from a place where under Reagan, the debt ran an average of about 35% of GDP, manageable. A little bit on the high side, but manageable. Under Bush Sr., it was 44% of the GDP. A little bit on the upper range and not where we like it. Under Clinton, it was 45% of GDP. Under Bush, 43, it was 36% of GDP. Today, it is 62% of GDP under this guy and on its way to 87% of GDP. That puts us in the same league as Greece. The problem is, one, we'd be on steroids. And second of all, there's no European Union to bail us out. If we get there, we'll be like, you know, we'll have high taxes, low growth, little prosperity, and we'll be like Argentina, some country of great promise that was astride the world stage and then fell out and fell back because it couldn't manage its finances. And it's a problem. And the problem is we can't solve it alone. Yeah, we can start nibbling away, and the Congress is going to do that. But these big things of entitlement reform cannot be done unless we have a president who stands up and says, I'm going to work with parties on both sides of the aisle in order to solve the problem before it's too late for our country. We're talking about the prosperity of America for our kids and our grandkids. We'll all be okay. Most of us in the room, we'll be fine. We'll be seeing a sort of a fading picture of our country, and we'll be scrimping a little bit more than we'd like to, but where it will really hurt is our kids and our grandkids when they get stuck with the tab that we ran up on their behalf. And that is morally wrong and wrong for America. Absolutely. Then we got one other problem. We got a government that seems to think it knows better and knows more and can regulate the heck out of us. We got a nanny state coming. Oh yeah, we need to do something about CO2. We're all breathing out too much of it. By God, we got global warming going on. Just take a look around what's happening here in Denver today. You know, by God, we have not been able to deal with the biggest problem facing our rural economy and our rural environment, and that is all that dust that gets kicked up. By God, we need to come up with some kind of biomass thing made out of recycled copies of the New York Times that we could spread across the entire southwest part of the United States, and, you know, maybe have some reverse fans so that when the wind comes blowing from the west, we can push it back to the west with fans blowing from the east in order to keep down that dust that covers Lubbock every single spring. We need a sound science, cost-benefit analysis, and some practical realism that comes from having real-world experience. We have too many nutty professors from some Ivy academic background who don't understand how the real world works, who are in charge of regulatory policy, and it's going to bankrupt the country if we let them do it. You know, our country is a rich and prosperous country that has used its prosperity to clean up the environment. It has used its prosperity to make our country better than it was, to make our air better, our land better, and our water better. We've done it as a measure of national principle, and we've also done it as a matter of economic efficiency and personal responsibility. I love the little video about stewardship. If you mishandle your land, you pay for it. If you don't pay proper attention to what the land needs and how it needs it, you pay a price. And yet, that doesn't seem to sink in with some people in Washington, D.C. who seem to think they know better than you. Look, I think we're at a crossroads. I'm a pretty optimistic guy. Yeah, I saw you looking at the watch. We're getting to the end. Don't worry, Bubba. You know, I'm a pretty optimistic guy, but we are at a crossroads. The country is really at a point where, over the next couple of years, we're going to decide whether we go here or we go there. We're going to make a decision whether we're going to be what we have been and what we have all been blessed to live in, a land and a nation of freedom and liberty and responsibility, or whether we're going to be something else, something where the dreams are constrained and the vision is cramped, some nice little country like there is in the north of Europe, you know, just sort of another thing, just sort of down there with Uruguay and Honduras. Or we're going to decide that we're going to be the United States of America, the shining light to the world, the beacon of liberty, the source of innovation and competition and big dreams, a place that has rescued the world twice in the 20th century and is leading in the fight that will determine the shape of this young century of ours. You know, we also have to make a decision whether we're going to be a part of it. There are frankly some people, and I live part of my time in Washington, D.C., so I get to hang around them. They want us just to accept it. It's inevitable. It's going to happen. Just let it go. Just go back to your private life and don't worry about the public life of our country. But you know what? I don't think that's who you are. I know some of you, and I know that you aren't that way. You want to have a role. You want to have a voice. You want to have an influence in making our country what you want it to be. First thing you ought to do is you ought to write a check to the PAC. You got a lot more suburban congressmen in your congressional delegations, a lot more suburban legislators that are going to be there as a result of redistricting, and you need to have a voice, not to buy influence. You got influence. You can walk in the door. What you need to do is have a tool to help you elect people who share your concerns and understand your problems and will work with you. And replace people who won't. Only 5% of the membership of this organization write a check to the PAC. That's sorry. It needs to be a lot higher. But more important than that is you need to be personally involved and not just writing a check. There was a lanky lawyer in Sangamon County, Illinois in 1840 who, to my mind, was the most brilliant political operative I've ever heard of. He wrote a magnificent little letter to his campaign committee. He said, make a perfect list of the voters, ascertain with certainty for whom they will vote, have the undecideds talked to by someone they hold in confidence, and on election day make certain that every Whig is brought to the polls. Now, Abraham Lincoln was not only our greatest president, but I thought he was a pretty good practical politician. And I've always thought the most important part of that letter that he wrote in 1840 was point number 3. We think about politics and the public life of our country has taken way up there. Oh, we got polls and focus groups. We got television ads. We got elite opinion makers. We got smart people. That's not part of it. You know, I'm not part of it. That all takes place up there. But Lincoln was right. What happens in politics and what happens in the public life of our country is that people talk to people and people listen to those they hold in confidence. You take a look at health care. When we started talking about health care reform in January, February, and March of 2009, public opinion polls showed the general concept was supported by 2.5 to 1. By August, people had educated themselves about the bill and were showing up at town hall meetings asking tough questions. And by the time the bill passed, the bill was 44% in favor and 47% opposed. That's after the President of the United States made 58 speeches in 51 weeks, and the advocates of reform spent $150 million on television, and the opponents spent less than 10. And what happened? People turned against the bill. And even today, the bill is less popular than it was at the time that it passed. And why did that happen? It's because doctors and nurses and small business operators and people who are concerned about it educated themselves about the bill and changed public opinion. That's what you can do on the issues of concern to your industry and your livelihood if you get involved and stay involved. Now, will we prevail? Will we prevail in this? I think so, but I recognize the question depends upon the answer to another question. What do you believe is the condition of the American spirit, the American character, our American values? Are we a country that's just going to be so supinely say, well, we'll just accept what Washington sends our way, or are we going to try and turn it around? I know what the answer ought to be, and I think I know what the answer is about American character. I gave a speech a couple years ago I did not want to give. I have a nutty friend that I met. I bought a car from him in the panhandle of Florida. I have a little place down there. He's a retired Navy SEAL. I bought a car from him and struck up a friendship. He's completely insane. He called me up a couple years ago and said, I want you to come down and give a speech. He said, I want you to come and give a speech to the Navy Special Warfare Foundation. I can't pay you a nickel. You'll have to cover your own expenses. I'll get you a room for one night at the Sheraton in Virginia Beach, and I'll try and get you an ocean view, but I can't promise it. I said, I don't want to come. He said, well, you got something on your schedule? I said, no. September 10th. I didn't have anything on my schedule. He said, well, we want you to come. I said, I can't come, Jeff. He said, why not? I said, because I know who these guys are. The Navy Special Warfare Foundation takes care of Navy SEALs and their family if the SEAL is wounded or killed in combat or training. And for 7 years, 6 years at the White House, I read the reports of what these people did in dark and dangerous places. Extraordinary things on behalf of our country. And I told him, I said, Jeff, I know what your guys do. And there's not a damn thing I can say that would properly honor them. He said, sorry, I told him you were coming. So I went. He also said, look, don't worry. You'll be the second speaker. We got the deputy director of the National Counterterrorism Center's coming, Admiral so-and-so, and so you'll be the second speaker. So I show up. This is my speech today. That's my outline. I wrote out every single word I was going to say that night. Literally, every single word. Because I knew if I didn't have it written in front of me, if I had to sort of wing it, offer out, I'd look at these SEALs and their wives, and I'd lose it. I'm sort of an emotional guy. And I'd look around at these guys and I'd say, I can't hold it together. So I wrote out every single word. And I show up. And of course, the National Counterterrorism Center deputy director has a real job, has canceled. I'm the only speaker. So beforehand, I'm circulating around with these SEALs and their wives and all the supporters of them. A bunch of them were in their civilian dress because they're getting ready to go out to Afghanistan. And they all had facial hair, and you can't wear your Navy dress uniform with facial hair, except one guy didn't have a beard and he was in his navy whites. And I said, hey man, what's up with you? You're leaving in a week, and don't you have to grow a beard in region, you know, for in territory? He said everyone else on my team has got a girlfriend or a wife. I'm trying to get one before I go. He said, I can always grow a beard in Afghanistan, but I can't get a girlfriend there. I said, best of luck to you. So Jeff, my buddy Jeff, comes up to me and he says, look, there's a guy here who loves you. He says he's a Navy SEAL named Lieutenant J, last name classified. He loves you. He loves watching you on Fox. He loves reading you. He's a big political guy, loves Bush. I'd like to bring him up and have him meet you. And I said, great, bring him up. Love to meet him. He said, I want to warn you, he's hard to look at. He was shot 8 times in Baghdad. And he went off to get him. And you know how you sometimes make a snap judgment about somebody and it turns out to be totally wrong? So I'm seeing this guy. I'm seeing Jeff make his way over. And he's got this young guy next to him, about 24, 25 years old, in his Navy dress. And this guy is hard to look at. I mean, his face is all cattywampus and sewed back together. And I'm looking at this guy and I'm saying to myself, God dang it, this guy is one wounded spirit. And God, it is, I'm going to have to throw my arm around him and buck him up. God dang it, he looks bad. And he makes his way up to me and I get introduced to him. And I couldn't have been more wrong. This kid was funny and charismatic and outgoing and energetic. And he was just fun to be around. I said, how are you doing? He said, well, I'm doing pretty good. He said, I've had 22 procedures. He said, of course, if you're a Navy SEAL, he says, every big blankety-blank, blankety-blank, blankety-blank doc in the world wants to operate on you so they can brag about it afterwards. I said, what you got coming up? He says, well, I'm going to Chicago tomorrow. He said, they're going to rebuild part of my cheek and my face. A bullet had come and shot off part of his nose and his cheekbone. Actually, it had come from behind and shot it off. He had a big blue piece of plastic on the side of his face covering the gaping wound. He said, hell, all I was trying to do was show a SEAL could grab a bullet with his teeth. I said, what you got after that? He said, I got a couple more procedures after that, and then I'm back in the game. I said, I beg your pardon? He says, yeah, I'm back in the game. He said, my team's going to Afghanistan, and they need me. And you knew in that moment they did. They needed a guy like this. They really did. So, I met his wife, who was a lot of fun. He told me, he said, I'd like to introduce you to her. He said, I met her, sounding like in a bar. He said, I knew she was something special because the first thing I told her was run away. And when she didn't run away, I knew she was special. He went off to get her a drink. I really liked her. She was a lot of fun, too. She came up, and I knew immediately who was in charge because she had a glass. And she sort of went like this to him and pointed to the bar, and off Lieutenant Jay runs to get her a drink. I mean, I knew he was in charge. I said, I don't mean to intrude. I said, but, you know, he told me he wants to be back in the game. And, you know, how do you feel about that? And she said, this is what God made him for. I'm for it. They couldn't have been more than 24, 25 years old. So I got up and gave my speech and then went back to my Sheridan room with the not sea view and drove back to Washington the next morning. And when I got there, I had an email from my nutty friend Jeff and thanking me for coming, including a couple of pictures, a couple of JPEGs, which I opened up. One of them was Lieutenant Jay in his Baghdad hospital room, and it's a horrible picture. It's horrific. You look at this picture, and you wonder how a human being could be under all those bandages and tubes and wires and everything. It's just terrible to look at. And the second one was a picture that I keep with me every day. I keep it in my briefcase because I don't want a day to go by that I don't think about this kid. This is a picture. This is a sign that Lieutenant Jay, last name classified, put on his Baghdad hospital room. He took his Navy Trident emblem, right there, a SEAL emblem, and stuck it into the sign. This is a powerful emblem for SEAL. When a teammate is killed, every SEAL team member takes their Navy Trident and jams it into the wooden coffin, and it's buried with their teammate. So it's powerful medicine. Attention to all who would enter here. If you're coming into this room with sorrow or to feel sorry for my wounds, go elsewhere. The wounds I received, I got in a job I love, doing it for people I love, supporting the freedom of a country I deeply love. I am incredibly tough and will make a full and complete recovery. What is full? That is the absolute utmost physically my body has the ability to recover. Then I will push myself about 20% further through sheer mental tenacity. The room you're about to enter is a room of fun, optimism, and intense rapid regrowth. If you're not ready for that, go elsewhere. Signed, the management. Now, I want to keep this with me. I want to keep it with me because I want it as a reminder every single day to me of what it is to be an American. of what the responsibility we have to love our country. Look, we can't all of us go into combat, and thank God they don't drag us all into combat. Some of us be pretty damn bad at it, starting with the ponytail president you got coming out. But it is a reminder that we have an obligation to love our country and to serve our country and do what we can to put the country in the right direction. Recognize we may not always be right, not to be dogmatic and insistent about it, to work together in a cooperative spirit where we can, but to stand for fundamental values of freedom and responsibility and liberty that have made this country exactly what it is. You represent those values. You represent those values in your life, in your lifestyle, in your livelihood. And it's time for all of us to stand up for those values. Thanks for having me here today.